Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Welcome back, everybody. Hope you had a Merry Christmas, and we'll all have a happy and healthy and maybe even a sane New Year. You're listening to The Chicago Way, Radio Free Chicago in podcast form with me, John Cass, mild-mannered columnist, and my friend and master pie baker, the brilliant sound stylist and WGN producer Jeff Carlin. The Chicago Way isn't only a podcast, it's a way of understanding things. And if you know one thing about Chicago, it's this. It's not the loud noises that tell you the truth, it's the silences that tell you. Ci fa se acquiescente, says my barber Raphael. The one who doesn't say agrees to it. And I thought about that after I was kicked out of a wake the other night. The first wake I was ever kicked out of. The wake of Chicago's most famous media hero and outfit cop, William Hanhart. Being kicked out of the wake just a few feet from the late chief of detectives in his coffin was rather dramatic, kind of like a Scorsese movie, and I'll tell you all about it later on in the show. But we've got other things to talk about first, including the death 10 years ago of Iraq's dictator Saddam Hussein. Yeah, 10 years. Hard to believe. We'll be interviewing the man who interrogated Hussein for CIA, former intelligence analyst John Nixon. And his new book, Debriefing the President, The Interrogation of Saddam Hussein, is a must-read. Why? Because the CIA is at war with Trump, or he's at war with intelligence, and this is the time to read it. But also, Chicago's reeling from the gang wars and the murders on the streets. Mayor Rahm Emanuel is trying but flailing. The Democrats are about to install their supreme boss. Illinois House Speaker Michael J. Madigan is the con. And Chicago's favorite son, President Barack Obama, comes to town to deliver his farewell speech. And I can't think of anyone better to discuss this with than Scott Stannis, the great editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune. Okay, Scott Stannis, after that big build-up, genius cartoonist and all that.
Oh, boy.
We've got two things we got to talk about, guys, and that is...
Only two?
Well, we got plenty, but two that I want to get to. Mike Madigan, Khan of Madiganistan, will be installed, or should be installed, in the coming days as the boss of everything in Illinois, by a Democratic caucus that pretends to be independent. And then we have Obama, the President Barack Obama, Chicago's favorite son, who, as you recall, was found floating as an infant on a reed basket in the Chicago River, and then later performed miracles by withdrawing the sword of reform from the cornerstone of City Hall, much to the amazement of the peasants and gentry.
And then they danced.
And then we danced. So what do you make of all this, Scott?
Well, let's go to the Obama thing first and put it in historic context. If you know, well, okay, it's the 21st century. I get that. And he sends out a thing over Medium saying, you know, George Washington was the first one to do the farewell address. And they actually cite that these guys wrote them down and mailed and sent them to the Congress.
Right. It would be better if you just mailed them.
Well, and here's the thing is that every other president, most other presidents have done that. And it's a good and worthy tradition. You know, here's what we accomplished together. Here's where I hope the country goes. You know, guys, keep it real. See you later. First off, this guy ain't going anywhere. He's going to stay in Washington, D.C. So if you notice, he's not moving back to Chicago, by the way. Isn't Is he keeping the house?
No. Well, they're leasing the house supposedly because his daughter's going to finish high school there. And
who they lease it to? Tony Resco?
No. They're leasing the house in D.C.
D.C. They're also supposedly leasing a house in California.
Right. I thought that the kids had voted to move to, which is weird. It makes no sense. A little town, a very Tony suburb of Palm Springs.
Don't you know where he's
Rancho Mirage.
Yes, that's where President Ford.
Are you bleeping kidding me?
No, I kid you not.
How you doing? Yeah. Rancho Mirage, huh?
Right.
Yeah. Nice.
And then, of course, they built a gigantic house in Hawaii, which is going to be their official residence, but that won't be, I don't think that's done yet.
And then what about his job, which is to not shut up and talk incessantly for years to come before he's installed as the Secretary General of the United Nations and can have one world government with that Uthant haircut that he's got going? No?
Oh, no, I think you're right. And the thing is, he won't shut up. George W. Bush, for all of his faults, no matter what side of the aisle, is he very class, with a great deal of class, stepped back and let the next president do his thing.
Became a painter.
This guy's not going to do that. But going back, coming to the Chicago farewell address, the point I'm trying to make in a very long way is that, no, it's my fault because the ADD kicks in, is that the former, all the other presidents who have done it have addressed the nation either through radio and then obviously television later, but it was addressed from the Oval Office, from the White House. He's doing the Obama pep rally. You know, the cheer, the mob scene. It's really, in my mind, unseemly, but it's been an unseemly, you know, couple of years.
That's
so.
Kind of a, it's interesting you make that point. That's very, it's something he and Trump share, is they have this idea of
ego.
Ego, obviously, but this penchant for the theatrics of it, the ability to tell a good tale, to be able to have a narrative that people can latch into.
Yeah.
I mean, we saw Trump obviously run the table with Hillary because he was able to do that. But Obama, too, I mean, where it all started, coming back, everybody from all his campaigs are invited.
Well, that's the other thing. That's the other thing that's BS about this. He's going to finish it where he started. No. John, you know this. He didn't start it here in Chicago. He started, if you notice, it when he started his career after his law career and his organizing career. But where he launched his campaign in 2007 was Springfield.
That's where he was on his knees literally before Emil Jones, boss of the South Side, saying, "Please, Senator Jones, make me a senator."
Remember those times I got you coffee? Remember that? John's fictional story.
Am I getting this right? That's not the Risco I knew?
That's a boneheaded. It was boneheaded of me to deal with Tony Risco.
That's
all
not the
that
Risco
nonsense,
I knew.
Right?
That's
I
not
mean,
the Risco I knew.
Right. So if you like Trump, if you like Obama's policies, you will ignore all that stuff. Just like people, you know, it's just partisanship where people ignore stuff or like it depending on who they, you know, who's in. It's all tribal and nonsensical. The fact is, he hasn't had. I think back on what has he really done? He's done nothing for Chicago. He has done absolutely nothing. The people are getting slaughtered on our streets. For all you want to say about Rahm Emanuel, and I have, you know, the guy needs a little help here. Nothing. We've got, what do? They come down, when Hydea Pendleton dies, they come and make a speech. And now all he's really going to do is preside over the big golf course near his presidential temple, right?
The Tiger Woods golf course.
Is that what it's called?
It's going to be Tiger Woods?
Tiger Woods has signed on to design it.
Okay, it's
great, nice. We're just giving
location.
Them some land.
What? It's a great location
for the golf course.
Yeah, it's it's not great now, but it's
two
great
blocks
location.
Away.
Well, what says the Obama years more than playing golf?
Maybe that'll pique his interest in solving or helping solve our problems.
And right,
maybe,
near there on 58th in Indiana,
and maybe he'll show up. That'd be nice.
There was an open air drug market, and it was there was a wall that's about 20 feet high. 30 feet high, and on it, spray painted in red, was Cain Ain't Abel, and it was there for years. Any of you guys know, particularly coppers who used to drive around there? No, you know? And now they scrubbed it, tore it down. It was torn down years ago. It was like it was ready for this. Gosh, it was like, and now they put it in, now they're doing the library. Oh, man. Like, really? I'm surprised. There was a coincidence.
So do you have tickets to the speech?
I think I'd rather watch it on TV, though he did put out a, there's something that one of the editors, Trevor Jensen, my direct line editor, sent me, where Obama says, what are the things that I should, what would you like, or what do you think I've done, or assess my presidency, or some kind of interactive nonsense. So I might do something on a column about it next week.
Well, he stabbed Israel in the back in with his, probably his best, our bestest buddies he's made for the country, you know, the Castros and Iran. So
don't forget the toilet paper nation, Venezuela, right?
Yeah, he probably misses Hugo every day.
It's really been Libya, the disasters there. Hillary Clinton, for all her faults, and I counted them many, many times, she had to basically eat his sins there in foreign policy and say they were hers.
Well, Donald Trump said they were hers.
Well, let's put it this way. She didn't distance herself
from
him,
didn't.
Right? She couldn't because she needed the black vote to have a hope of surviving. And now I'm just depressed. I'm depressed because I'm not happy. I'm not happy about Trump. And everyone's like, oh, you love Trump. You're a Trump lover.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh, man, come on.
Before we pivot into the Khan of Madagascar, I mean, we're glossing over this. How was everyone's New Year's and Christmas? And
you tell us first, Jeff Carlin, how was yours with the lovely Christine, we're waiting for her to come on the podcast and give us the inside Jeff Carlin TMZ moment.
That's good. That was good. Mine was.
They pay me to. Right, not talk.
No, I got it. That's fun. Mm-hmm. It was good. For us, I mean, I worked a little bit. I was actually here for the station on Christmas night, filling in for an emergency fill-in situation. But it was good. I saw my family, saw Christine's family, and a lot of Christine's family listened to the podcast.
Really?
There's a lot of Cassian friends out there, Casso
really?
Supporters.
Meat eaters, I hope.
Yes. In fact, some Western Springs types who love when you mention Casey's because they love Casey's too. Not that they're giving us anything, but still.
I got one for you.
Okay.
Scott, before you walked in, we were doing some pre-production work, and we had interviewed John Nixon, who's the CIA, former CIA analyst who did the interrogating Saddam Hussein.
And cool.
It's really an interesting book, and he kind of condemns everybody. But what happened was I get a call, right, Jeff?
Oh, my God, yes.
I get a call because I'd gotten a – and the call was – sir, we know who sent your package.
Yeah, this is Jimmy from the wine company. We know who sent you that package.
It wasn't Jimmy from the wine company. It was someplace in Naperville, and they sent me a case of wine.
Nice.
And I didn't know who did it, so I'm freaking out. Like, why did you accept this, Betty and my mom? Why did you? I don't know who sent it.
Oh, it sent to
your
house.
Could be some wise guy. I don't accept people. I have people who've sent me letters to my home. That are business related. 20 years I haven't opened them. you want to reach me? You send me something to my house. Guess what? It's guaranteed.
Yeah.
I'm not opening it.
Yeah.
So they called in the middle of when we were taping because I'd called the company and asked who sent this wine, right? Who sent this stuff? And he said, "Why do you need to know, sir?" I go, "Yeah. What if it's from Chinatown or something? You know who?" Maybe one of those Chinatown cowboys.
Yeah.
Like Hopalong Cassidy over there. Somebody.
You're killing me. Where's the story going?
So he turns out, he tells me while I'm doing the podcast, he says, it's Regina, my sister-in-law. But it doesn't say that on the outside of the box.
Oh, boy.
So I'm like, my sister-in-law, I guess we could open it then. You know, right? Unless it's a fake sister-in-law, not my real one. Someone pretending.
It's very Homeland.
You know what? Her name's Regina. And I used to call her Gina, and Betty's like, don't call her Gina. I'm like, what are you talking about, Betty?
Yeah, we had, during the buildup to the Iraq War, I was in favor of the buildup, and things got, as you know, very ugly during that period. And we got a package to our house, and there was no return, nothing. It was from...
White powder?
It was not. It turned out to be a nice gift from a dear friend, but...
No severed ears.
No dead rabbit. No nothing. No, it was. I forget what it was. Something nice, but it was just like that's terrifying. And the thing is, if you go online for 3 minutes, I can find your home address and the last five places you've lived.
I don't like that.
Oh, I hate that. I hate it with a passion.
I don't like that, especially when I bother people sometimes in my column, and you bother people with your little cartoons.
Don't say little cartoons.
I don't mean little cartoons, but your cartoons. Particularly like Trump the Sheriff or your Madigan cartoons. You get a lot of you get some angry emails too, right?
Oh, gosh. In fact, Madigan bought the support of some women's group out in D.C. We talked about that when I was – because every time I draw his daughter Lisa, our attorney general.
The princess?
Yes, I already draw her as a little girl with a little pink dress and Lisa's in the script.
I like the Mary Jane shoes.
The eye dotted with a heart.
Yeah.
And so, and they – just attack. How dare you? She's she's an accomplished woman of
She's the boss's daughter.
So what'd you do for Christmas and New Year's?
What did I do?
Yeah.
I made soup. I didn't read podcast. I didn't read anything. I stopped. I fell away from social media.
Same here.
I just completely disengaged.
Were the kids home?
boys are home. They're still home. They're leaving this week. And yeah, so I made onion soup and so forth. It was fun. What about Scott Stennis Christmas? Do you have all the children gathered around in, while you're wearing your footy pajamas and do like little, you know, like on easels, and you all draw Christmas cards to each other?
No, but we well,
in
we're
the
not,
Scott Stennis style.
It's not far removed from that. I went down there and spent some time with my two boys and their wives, and it was great. Spent 2 weeks with them. We're all in the same house, so that can lead to drama, and there was no drama.
Down there is Alabama, right?
Down there is God's country, down there in Birmingham,
Alabama. What about kitchen issues? That leads to drama with different ladies in the kitchen.
Oh, I stay the hell away. And Janine is the queen of the kitchen.
So that's right. You don't tell the Sicilian Janine.
No, it's her world. We're just playing rent, you know? So, yeah, we actually, Janine made us all go by. Did you see the picture? Is that why you referred to footies?
No, I just thought in my mind.
I think
you
really
seem like a footy person.
I'm really sorry I brought this up.
Did you? Hey, wait a minute now. Let's get to it. Did you wear a footy?
Janine thought it would be a great idea, and it was fun. And we all went out on Christmas Eve day and bought onesies for the whole family. Not that we all fit in. And so I got to wear an elephant because being the Republican. So, one of my daughters-in-law, who the recent doctor, who's very serious, but she got a leopard one and wore it in the store. It was kind of hilarious.
Onesies.
So we all had onesies for Christmas.
These are not snuggies.
No, these are...
These are snuggies have open backs. I don't want to see...
You don't want to see...
Dan is walking through a Walmart with his back open,
No one deserves that.
So you had a snuggie. You had the little onesie.
I had the onesie. We all had onesies for Christmas Eve night. That was kind of fun. It was.
Did you have cocoa? Here's you with... let's draw the picture. He's in a onesie. He's been losing weight. You can see he's looking good.
Uh-huh.
I don't think... He had the robe open, and he's got
no robe. You just
no
wear the onesie.
Zip up, yeah, Jack.
Yeah, it's a front, zip
and,
up front.
And then he had the
like a scuba suit
with the vapor pen.
Vape, yeah,
right,
yeah.
His vape
and
pen in front of the fireplace.
Next thing you know, he tells you move to Wicker Park.
No, nothing. I'm not that far gone. No.
What did you get for Christmas, Scott Stennis?
I got some
pens, some Venus books. Color by number.
People demean what I do, and I just
no. What did you get?
I got some books I really wanted.
Which
one of things? I got Crazy, which is the story, a story in black and white. It's the story of George Harriman, the creator of Crazy Cat, who was actually had a lot of Negro blood in him, and until he was 10 and moved to Los Angeles, where he all of a sudden became white. At 10 years old.
Really?
His family, that's what families did back then, apparently.
Kind of like Greeks became white when Jackie Kennedy married.
And he tried to pass himself
John
off.
John Kennedy. He became officially white then.
He tried to pass himself off as Greek, as a matter of fact.
Really?
Chairman, yeah.
And so did he ever acknowledge that he
never,
was?
Never, never. Really? And in those days, don't forget, he was cartooning in the teens, the 20s, and the 30s of the 20th century. He died in 1943.
Did he smoke hashish? Because some of those crazy cats are just kind of weird.
I think he was just a great artist. And yeah, they are great. I mean, they are bizarre. And apparently,
they give you
house,
that kind of pothead thing.
Yeah, I guess so. I never liked that stuff. So I never. In college, I had art students.
Me neither. I hated it.
Yeah. No, I'm one of the few guys who honestly just don't. I actually get paranoid and revved up. I can't sleep on this stuff. So I'm not going to say I never. I'm not like Bill Clinton. I did not inhale. I did it.
Reefer Madness, Scott Stennis.
Yes. No,
awesome.
I just got weird and paranoid. So, no, that never inspired me. Anyway, it was a great Christmas. It was about as wholesome as it gets, and it was wonderful.
And did you sing Christmas carols and stuff?
Yeah.
The second verse?
In church we do, yeah.
Nice. I like that idea.
You go to Midnight Mass? Well, your Christmas is different than my Christmas, right?
No, we are Christians.
I know you're.
And we do believe in the virgin birth.
Right, but
December
25th. So it is December 25th.
I'm not that columnist that writes that it really happened in March and that we're all stupid for.
No. But I
think some columnists.
Orthodox calendar is different than the Roman Catholic calendar.
Some of our Russian friends go their way. You know, we go the right way. Anyway, everybody.
John is the only man on the planet who calls me a Protestant because I'm a Roman Catholic.
He's not a Protestant. You're not a Protestant. What was that Protestant thing we used to talk? I don't know what was going on.
What was the schism? You know, we just want to say all is forgiven. I actually spoke at Carthage College up in Wisconsin, and it's a Lutheran college. Mm-hmm. And I opened up by saying, you know, as a Roman Catholic, I just want to tell you all here in the audience today, all is forgiven. Come back. Come back.
That's what I said, too.
And the professors did not laugh. The students did.
Ten years ago, CIA analyst John Nixon interrogated the captured Iraqi strongman Saddam Hussein. Nixon has now written a book, Debriefing the President, The Interrogation of Saddam Hussein. It raises questions about Hussein's capture, whether we should have been there in the first place to lose precious American lives, but it's also about the relationship between CIA and the president, and there's no better time to read it than now, as Donald Trump, who's fighting with the agency over whether Putin hacked or didn't hack the elections, takes office. Hello, Mr. Nixon. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You spent how long with CIA?
I was there for 13 years, from 1998 to 2011.
And you interrogated Saddam Hussein.
Yes.
But you just didn't come to work one day and get, you know, a notice and an email telling you, come on and interview Saddam Hussein. You had spent your lifetime, I assume, or much of your professional career studying Iraq, learning languages, and studying this man's personality and what he was like.
Yes. I did some graduate work at Georgetown University, and I worked on Iraq and the first Gulf War. And then I joined the agency in 1998, and they put me into what was then called Iraq Issue. And I was a leadership analyst, so my specialty was focusing on the country's leadership. And to be honest with you, the country's leadership was largely revolved around the person of Saddam Hussein.
Before we truly begin, I need to ask you, it's my understanding that any CIA employee, when writing a book, has to submit that manuscript to CIA for review. Was this submitted for review?
Yes, it was submitted for a review, and it took a very long time to get it out of their hands. And when you actually see a copy of the book, you'll see that there are redacted portions that they took some things out. And it's unfortunate, but oh well. You know, there's some things that you can't avoid. I was actually surprised that they didn't take more out. But it was a very long process, too long in my opinion.
How many years did you wait?
I first submitted the manuscript to the CIA in 2011, and then I got it back in about 3 or 4 months. But it's a three-step process now. You have to give it to them once where they tell you to cut things out. Then you have to give it to them a second time to show them that you took the things that they want out. Then you have to give it to them a third time right before you're going to go to press, just to make sure that there's nothing in there that they're upset about. And what happened was I gave it to them once, and I got it back. And then I took about 2 years off from the project because I was working in the Middle East, and I just kind of let the project sort of sit. And then when I came back, I picked it up and I gave it to them again. And all told, it took about 15 or 16 months for them to kind of clear my manuscript, which again was much, much too long.
Well, I want to get to the actual interview. So tell me what it was like to interview and interrogate Saddam Hussein.
Sure. It was the most challenging, the most interesting, certainly the most high profile assignment that I had in my career. You know, I worked primarily on Iran and Iraq throughout my 13-year career, and I it was, you know, at times surreal, you know, dealing with this guy. It was always interesting. It was exhausting because he loved to talk, and he loved to talk about himself. And he, we were in this sort of dingy guard room every day, but you were able to actually. It was weird because, you know, I was so used to talking about Saddam Hussein in the third person, and then all of a sudden he was sitting there right in front of me. And all of a sudden, I'd have to catch myself saying, so when Saddam said, and I'd be like, wait, so when you said, you know, and it was really, it was a freaky kind of feeling. He was at times he could be very charming when he wanted to be, and he was a very charismatic individual, but he was also, could be very nasty and very arrogant and really kind of had a real dark side to him. And every day it was sort of like a cat and mouse game.
And John, thanks again for joining us. Did you, when you were interviewing him and interrogating him, did he have a sense of humor at all? I mean, I see these people as who are in these big power positions. Obviously, they have to be charismatic to get people to follow them, but I always feel like sense of humor kind of follows that. Did he have any sort of joking as to, I mean, obviously it was a serious situation, but did you get that?
Yeah. There were a couple of times where he told us these humorous anecdotes, but all of the anecdotes he would bring up, they all had one theme in common, and it was him being sort of the string puller and somebody at the end of the string having sort of physical punishment inflicted upon them. And it was Saddam who was pulling the string. There was one time, though, when we were talking about, I was talking about something, and I tried to sort of create a story to goad him into talking about his intelligence network, because he didn't like to talk about sensitive issues. And he said to me, he said, you know, your intelligence is very low, meaning that I wasn't a very smart person. And so then, because it was kind of, I mean, even I didn't believe the story, but I was just trying to make conversation. Anyway, the thing is, my colleague then said, oh, you mean low intelligence, like sending your entire Air Force to your worst enemy, Iran, right after the start of the Gulf War, and then expecting to get them back? Are you talking about low intelligence like that? And so Saddam just kind of looked at him. And for a second there, his face just kind of like blanched, you know, and then he just broke out into the smile and started laughing, you know, and then he held up his finger and he said, touche. And we all broke up. You know,
it sounds like it would have been fascinating if it were reversed and he was still in power when you were talking to him. Right. I don't think he might have laughed, or he might have laughed. Who knows?
No. Right? I don't think he would have laughed either.
One of the things that I found so striking was your understanding that while you came to understand that you're interviewing the strong man of Iraq, and you find out that actually he's focusing more on writing a novel, and he hadn't been involved in running his own government. That to me is astounding. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, we were asking him questions, and then, you know, he just kind of got around to telling us that, you know, listen, you're asking me about things that I don't really know that much about, because, you know, I was working on this novel, and we were like, what? And so, and this was corroborated. You know, I went through the debriefings of some of the other principals that were captured and interrogated, and they all kind of said the same thing, that Saddam sort of disengaged. You know, he was really, you know, we kind of build these people up in our minds to be these, and we definitely did this at the CIA, where we believe that this is the master manipulator, and he's got his hand, he's playing this giant Wurlitzer organ, and he's got all the things going. And it wasn't the case. It wasn't the case at all, you know. And you know, it was really shocking to all of us, and certainly to me. And then I began to get an appreciation for what some of his top lieutenants, they were the ones who were basically running the government in his name. Now, it's not to say that Saddam disengaged completely. He still kept his hand on certain things, and he still maintained, I think, a very strong interest in regime security, and which really came down to his own security, and because that's something that he never took his eye off of. That's why he survived for as long as he did.
To my everlasting regret, I had supported the war in my column and written columns about if there's a rat in your kid's room, you have to kill it because it's dangerous. And I was listening to all this stuff about weapons of mass destruction and threats and terror and the government kind of stampeding us into this thing. And later talking to soldiers who, as young men, read my column and joined and then come back as sergeants saying, "We shouldn't have been there, sir." And I still haven't reconciled my shame about this. I wonder, what were your thoughts? What are your thoughts on it now?
Oh, John, I'm with you 100%. I too supported the war, and I thought we were going to be. I thought, you know, I, like everybody else, thought he had weapons of mass destruction, or at least was working his way towards that goal, and I never heard anybody ever, ever, and this is anybody in our country, the UK, any of our allies, anyone. I never heard anyone question it. And, you know, I thought we were going to be, and even after it became clear that he had no weapons program, I thought, well, you know, this is done. This is already done. But maybe we can make this a better place for Iraqis. You know, maybe we can help build this country, you know, or at least give them the tools that they need to kind of govern themselves. And when I look at what we did to that country, and when I look at, you know, the sacrifices of 4,000, the families of 4,000 men and women who died, and the countless thousands who came back not in a good way, and are still struggling today, it really, and when I think about all the Iraqis who have suffered, it's something I think about every day, and it breaks my heart, kind of, to know that, you know, this is what we did. And when I think that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, because I was, to be honest with you, by 2008, 2009, I was just so angry. I was so angry about the war. I was so angry about the Bush administration. I was so angry about leaders who use their power in such indiscriminate ways. And it you know, eventually propelled me to write this book. And the book is very candid. And I'm not one of these people. I didn't write this book to plug myself or to, to take care of my friends.
That's why,
you know,
we have you on.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote this book because, you know, I wanted to say, folks, this is what happened. Because, you know something, this is now history. And I've already seen the historians kind of getting this part of things wrong. And that's, I wanted to have this sort of straightened out.
What did they get wrong?
Oh gosh, you know, let's see. That Saddam told us that he was going to restart his weapons program after he got out from underneath the sanctions. That Iraq was a gathering menace. You know, there was I briefed President Bush and Vice President Cheney and various high-level policymakers, and they were all, I mean, this was in 2008, 5 years after he is removed from power, and yet they were still looking for the justifications in the war. And one of the things that really bothered me was that they, Rumsfeld, Tenet, Bush, and I think Rice, but I'm not sure, but I know those three, all had this little anecdote in their books about how Saddam was going to come and kill the Bush children, you know, the Bush's daughters, in revenge for killing Saddam's sons. And this was just complete nonsense. And we told them this in 2003. We said there is no evidence to support that this is even true. And in light of what happened when we found Saddam, he couldn't even get reception on his radio, let alone be sending hit squads to the United States. And yet they still, 2009, President Bush is still putting this down as though this is a justification for getting rid of Saddam. And it's a lie. It's just a lie.
So why were we there? If there weren't, why were we there? To destabilize Iran? To create, to add, put gasoline on the Shia-Sunni fight?
There were a number of reasons. I think chief among them was, when the Bush team came into office, Iraq was viewed as unfinished business. And they didn't know how they were going to do it, but eventually they were going to get around to Saddam Hussein and finally solve this problem in American foreign policy. And then 9/11 came along, and then that really gave them the all the justification they needed. The very next day, they were seeking linkages between Saddam and 9/11, linkages that weren't even there. And one of the ironies that I mentioned in my book is that Saddam thought 9/11 was going to bring the United States and Iraq closer together. He thought that, the United States will, of course they'll see that we had nothing to do with this, and of course they'll understand that we are threatened by the same enemy. And he couldn't have been more wrong. I'm sorry.
No, I just wanted to tell everybody, in case they hadn't heard, we are speaking to John Nixon, the former CIA analyst and author of the book Debriefing the President in the Interrogation of Saddam Hussein. In your book, sir, you also reveal some interesting, some insights about CIA itself and its bureaucracy, particularly when it comes to the valuing experience. And I'm sure it's like any big bureaucracy. The bureaucrats are the ones who do the, who prosper, and people who think outside the box creatively are tend to be seen as threats. How did you find it?
It's almost like you worked there, that's exactly what it was like. And they said that they would tell you that they valued expertise and they wanted you to develop your expertise. But over time, I found that they really kind of distrusted expertise. And I think this was part of the sort of reaction to the Bush years, in which the CIA became this pinata to just hit with a baseball bat whenever the administration wanted to, and we had to sit there and take it, and they just sort of hunkered down and just tried to cover themselves, and part of covering themselves was sort of watering down the analysis and either saying nothing, which is really very good, because if you say nothing, then you can't be accused of being wrong, or basically giving, the administration what they wanted, which actually throughout my entire time that I was at the CIA, that was sort of a way of life there. Under George Tenet, who was the director of the CIA, he had this management style of, it was something that he learned, I believe. His father ran a Greek diner in Queens, New York, when he was growing. George used to work in the diner. And I think he learned a lot from his father in his management style, which was basically always make the customer happy. Always make sure that they like what they're getting.
Well, I grew up in a Greek family, too. And I grew up as a butcher. I don't make my customers happy. Sometimes they get very upset with what I say. And I don't know if that's a function of ethnicity. I don't know if that is. Go on, sir.
I think it was more of a function of running the diner and making sure the customer was happy, because they would always come back for, if they were happy, then they would always come back for more, and that's how you built your business. And I think that George ran the CIA that way, which unfortunately made us focus on things that, you know, and made us ignore other things that we should have been looking at, and we should, prior to the war in Iraq in 2003, we should have been doing much wider research, particularly on what was going to happen in Iraq on the day after. You know, one of the shortcomings of the Bush team was that they not only never asked that question, but they didn't care about that question. And that was the most important question to answer.
Now, here's another question I'd like to know about. President-elect Trump is seemingly at odds, if not at war, with his intelligence community, as we call them, the people who spy on us and for us. And I wonder how you think that's going to shake out, given your understanding of the bureaucracy and the characterizations you've made with respect to wanting to please the customer. How's that all going to work?
Oh, gosh. You know, this is virgin territory for the CIA. I don't think they've ever dealt with a president like this. Maybe the only time, the closest example is that of Richard Nixon, who really had no time for the CIA whatsoever.
Nixon's books will be taught in colleges long after, at least responsible ones, long after we forget Barack Obama's rhetoric.
Nixon had a lot of experience in foreign affairs, and he knew most of the world's leaders. And, you know, and Donald Trump is not exactly in that league. So I'm very concerned by this, and I think that nothing good will come of a wall of mistrust between the president and his intelligence community. That's something that, if I was an enemy of the United States, that's something I would exploit. And, you know, we live in a world where, you know, we can't take those kinds of chances. And so I really wish, I would hope that, I mean, eventually, well, I guess they're going to have a meeting on Friday in which they're going to, you know, sort of talk about all of this, this Russian hacking thing, which seems to be the issue of the day that's dividing them. But it's not a good way to start things. And it sends absolutely the wrong message to the intelligence community. It basically sends the message of, you better get right with my worldview. And, you know, that we already had that with the Bush administration, and it led to disaster.
And we already know that there are those on the left who are manipulating the facts of this thing to destabilize Trump as well, or at least diminish him.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, there's no absolutely. Do foreign powers try to influence elections and each other? I think the United States sent people to Israel for that, and to Great Britain, and I'm sure that we've done, and they've done the same. I'm thinking of Jonathan Pollard, who was guest.
Right? Italy in 1940, right. In 1945 or 1947. I mean, it's one of the first great successes of the CIA was the campaign to influence the Italian elections against the communists. You know, look, first of all, did this throw the election off? Was Hillary going to win and the Russians threw the election to Trump? No, of course not. And you know something? Vladimir Putin didn't convince Hillary Clinton to put a server in her home, and he didn't tell her, hey, don't go to Wisconsin, and take for granted the votes of Pennsylvania and Michigan and Florida and Ohio.
But did he get Bill to do that uranium deal in Tajikistan or Uzbekistan with the dancing girls in the tent and the strongman? I don't know.
Well, my point is this, though. For those people who believe that, you know, first of all, hacking into the DNC and the RNC, I can't think of two more useless institutions in Washington, D.C., to be quite honest with you. And, yes, it produced some embarrassing information for Hillary Clinton, but, you know, that's not what lost her the election. But having said all that, I would say this. Did anybody really think that this day was never going to come when somebody would use a cyber attack against something in Washington? I mean, we've been doing this for years, for a really long time, and we've had some great successes. But you know something? It's the way things have evolved in the U.S.-Russian relationship they have looked at us. You know, did anybody say anything about like us expanding NATO? Sending observers to various former republics of the Soviet Union to inspect elections, to provide advice to opposition parties who are running against Moscow client candidates. You know, they see us as constantly meddling in their elections and their internal processes. So, I mean, it's sort of a very selective and, you know, at times kind of shocking the way we sort of see this become outraged, but yet don't recognize the same behavior in ourselves.
The barking of dogs is what happens when many journalists try to be analysts, John Nixon, particularly those who are partisan in nature. I want to thank you very much for your time. John Nixon, debriefing the president. The Interrogation of Saddam Hussein, a must-read for anyone who's been watching politics, and the ascension of Donald Trump and the war with his intelligence community. Thank you very much for joining us, sir.
Well, thank you for having me.
Great book.
It's a pleasure.
I wasn't even the real enemy. 9/11 was my time to be, and I never even made a WMD. Osama Bin Laden's free, but they sent an army after me. Despite my gross iniquity, and I could be so empty without him. La 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 la.
Who's your Baghdad?
La 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 la.
I'm off the Hizal Moshizal.
Silence has a sound, and it has a meaning. Ci fa se acquiescente, says my barber Raphael. The one who doesn't say agrees to it. And so here on the Chicago Way, it's right to note how silent Chicago had been when former Chicago Police Chief of Detectives Bill Hanhart was indicted for running the Chicago outfit's jewelry heist ring. The feds considered him Joey Lombardo's guy, the outfit's man. The detectives considered him the man who made them. And the politicians didn't want to say a damn thing when he was indicted. He died recently, and I went to pay my respects at the Cumberland Chapel. And I'm waiting in line and looking at all these, you know, at a wake, you see the flowers and pictures of, you know, heroic events and badges and plaques of honor and a lot of many notices to invitations to his various parties held at the Carlisle Banquet Hall.
Jeez.
And which is a nice place. I've been there. It's a nice place out in the western suburbs. And people were coming up to me to say hello, and I tried to do it low-key.
Sure.
I wasn't going like, you know, a spacon, as we say, right? I wasn't going there to show off. I just went there to pay my respects to the man. Because when he pled guilty, he asked for water, and the judge gave him water. And he took the glass, filled it with water, looked at me, raised the glass like salute, and drank the water. And I thought, right? Am I a dead man?
Stay out of Chinatown. Right?
So, but I do give him props for, there's just something away about the man, and his family loved him. So I'm in the wake, and a guy comes up to me and says, you know, right in front of the casket, like 10 feet away, I'm just in the end of the line, then you go in front of the casket. They say, guy says, little guy in powder blue sweater, not even a suit, says, hey, John Cass, the family doesn't want you here. The family wants you to go.
Really?
Yeah. And I said, pardon me, I came here to pay my respects, sir. I didn't use a fake British accent, Jeff, but I wanted to take umbrage. And there were people around me looking at it like, what? Oh, what's going on? And the guy grabs my elbow. He goes, we don't want a scene. And I said, get your hands off my f***ing elbow. Or we will have a scene right here in front of the body right now. And he's like, oh, sorry. And two coppers came up, old-time coppers. They're like, look, sorry this didn't work out, but we'll walk you out. And I'm thinking, Joey Lombardo's cop and cops are walking me out of that wake.
What a story.
So I sent my spies the next day because I couldn't go to the funeral. And one of my spies, you happen to know him, black guy, long cornrows.
Sure.
Blends right in into the whole white cop outfit funeral thing. And Midnight and Old School writes this beautiful note about the love of his family. And you could see the love, right, at that point. And they talked about, the priest talked about, read from Matthew, the shepherds and the sheep and the goats and how we're separated when we go to heaven, and could only talk about how much his family loved him. And I thought, isn't this amazing, right? You, nobody's all good or all evil, are they? Right? So you could be Joey Lombardo's cop. You could run the police department for the outfit and thoroughly corrupt the entire culture for years to come after your death. But you could also love your family, love your grandchildren, be there for them, be kind and listening. Right? Isn't that odd?
No, it's very human.
Is it? Jeff Carlin, you're just... You got this Cheshire Grin smile through the glass. What's going on?
It's incredible. I mean, just the intro and then your discussion, like when we were talking off air and you know, laying out who he was. But then this, just to have this image in my head of the flowers and the pictures and then the funeral. Yeah. I mean, that's something. There's somebody who is notorious yet seemingly, you know, a family person and loved and beloved or feared and be feared.
He showed up at a police district, it was like Mick Jagger showing up. Guys would come around him like he was the star, all right? They had a television show, you ever hear of it, Crime Stories?
Mm-hmm.
He was the guy. That was him. Dennis Farina was his buddy, but it was his life.
Oh, my God.
And there's a scene in it, in the opening of Crime Stories, where the Hanhart character sticks a gun into the mouth of the Tony Spilotro character at the end of it. And says, this is my town, you son of a bitch. And you can't be a gangster in my town. This is Chicago. We're fighting to keep you guys out of there. And I'm thinking, while that's going on, there's jewelry being stolen. And coppers being made detective. And when Hanhart was finally indicted, and I went up to Daly, I said, well, what do you have to say about it? He's like, John Knight wasn't sullied. Camp wasn't sullied. Sirianni wasn't sullied. He started mentioning three police officers who were killed. And I said, that has nothing to do.
Yeah, that's a weird response.
Well, because they don't want to say. You understand? Even when he was indicted, they didn't want to say. I think he's going to make a hell of a book. What do you think?
Well, why don't you write it?
Maybe. But you can't write it silently. You have to write it with words on paper.
That's true.
The Chicago way.
It's the Chicago way.
What did he do after...
He came out and apparently, you know, he had all these showbiz connections. People were thinking about making a movie about him.
Ah.
He was, there are two stories about him. One that William Hanhart, if you look at pictures of him, handsome young guy, big, strong, kind of brutal, but smart. I don't think Hanhart changed anything about corruption in this town. I told the family before they kicked me out of the wake. I said, I don't think he didn't create the system. He was just part of the system. And in those days, that was the system.
You don't think that's the system now?
Jeff Carlin, Scott Stannis, John Cass, John Nixon, thanks for being here. Remember, on the Chicago way, don't listen to the noise. Listen to the silence.